I know it's time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us on a Friday morning. He has his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And we have a chat about the media, the stories, the media, the stories, the media, and the stories on a weekly basis. Good morning, David.
Well, hello there. I'm glad to be reporting in again in from the great state of Maine, taking what is becoming a very extended break from the media capital of the world, my home base, New York City. And I'm happy, as always, to be joining the ever-incisive Marshall Miles. Another quite a week, huh?
You know, we have so many different things that are popping up on the screen. Of course, the January 6th hearings, I have to admit, even though they started off kind of rough with almost being produced like a movie, but now the information that is coming out is downright chilling, and not chilling in the way like a murder movie, but chilling in the fact that, damn it, this has happened once again at the highest level of our government.
Yeah. Yeah, and the news overnight from the what was supposed to be the last hearing of the Select Committee of Congress examining the events and indeed the whole significance of the January 6th attack on the Capitol has been very striking, as you say, and chilling. Give me a moment just to widen the lens a bit, Marshall. There's quite a global picture. As you said, things are popping up on our screen in every direction. And there's quite a global picture offered by the media this week of national leaders everywhere being toppled. I mean, you've noticed, of course, Sri Lanka's president being driven from that small island country. Italy's prime minister having to resign after losing a no-confidence vote. Britain's already resigned, but not quite yet out. Prime Minister Boris Johnson, of far from blessed memory now, watching and pouting as his party chooses his successor from what's now a narrow downfield of just two candidates. And here, of course, at home, it's all history we're talking about now, though only 18-month-old history. But the story continues to emerge more fully, as it has overnight, of how our own then-president as well was desperately trying on to power after he was voted out. That story of desperately trying to hang on to power is, of course, common to all of these toppled leaders, except perhaps Italy's Premier Mario Draghi, who summed up some gracefulness in his departing. He even tried, as his constitutional president urged him to, to go back and attempt to some reasoned persuasion with his coalition partners to rethink their sabotage tactics against him. But they remained determined to oust him, with, of course, the aim of replacing him with themselves in the top position. As the local and international press has been reporting, even though Draghi is popular with the public and has achieved a surprisingly long stretch of stable government in a country not famous for it, there's so much factional fighting between the parties in Parliament that when the national elections take place, as they now have to after his resignation, the chances seem to be that the country's far right will be able to squeeze in and take power. There's factionalism on all sides, of course, but the danger is that the far right groups, including the neo-fascists, Italy still has fascists despite their defeat and ejection in World War II, are much more likely to unite together than the various elements of the Italian center-left. Every time I've been to Italy, sent there to report on its politics, Marshall, that danger of resurgence of fascism has been the dangerous prospect I'd be covering. One documentary I made was even called Challenge from the Past. Not a great title, I'll admit, but we were thinking of Mussolini, of course, and the idea of his ghost returning. And maybe just maybe that's what will happen for real this time. Italy has previously, in recent memory, of course, come close to that retrogressive kind of rule. Silvio Berlusconi, what was his name? Silvio Berlusconi brought us close. He, you remember, of the infamous and salacious bunga bunga parties, as he called them. Worse, conceivably, they were, apparently, than Boris Johnson's drunken, vomit-laced, so-called work event parties at 10 Downing Street. And Berlusconi is hovering now on the scene again, parading his singular, lick-spittling glorification of Russia's Vladimir Putin. And he's not alone in Italy. Another far-right so-called populist who's likely to be influential in the new mix is Matteo Salvini, boss of the League Party, which Italian journalists describe as a hard right grouping. And Salvini, too, has been effusive in his praise of Putin. In a Europe that senses itself in dire need of strong unity in the face of Putin's bullying aggression, these developments in Italy can't fail to worry people even more. At a time of great worry already, Draghi, I should note, was an especially vigorous supporter of Ukraine and its fight against Putin's invasion. And that, of course, that element of his stalwart attitude is now disappearing from the scene. Let me just talk about Sri Lanka as well while we do this international review.
Absolutely.
I was sent to Sri Lanka also. I was there to cover their long-lasting civil war, well before the now-replaced autocracy of the Rajapaksa family. That war, though, which entailed vicious massacring of the country's minority ethnic group, the Tamils, ushered in Rajapaksa's high-handed and oppressive rule, subjecting the Tamils and anyone else not considered part of their own elite grouping to systematic discrimination and exclusion. I guess if you elect people, especially a family grouping, who are interested in just power for power's sake, more than for service to the people, then you're likely to get, as the Sri Lankans have got, stupefying mismanagement of the country's economy, corruption and incompetence throughout the government, brutal suppression of dissidents, and of course a clique of sycophants surrounding the man at the top. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? And that is the mess that the new president, Ranil Wickremesinghe, has inherited, along with deep suspicion among the public about his connections to the deposed regime. Talk about a mess. As Wickremesinghe assumes office, the country's central bank is now forecasting 70% inflation in the coming months, and we here in the U.S. are worried about 9% inflation. The question is whether Wickremesinghe can pull off anything like national recovery, perhaps with some massive cash injection from the International Monetary Fund. He can do it. We'll see, won't we, to use that time-honored reporter's get-out clause. I'm sorry about that, but, you know, we have to say only time will tell.
Now, I want to go back to your show last week. You notified me of something, and the reaction to your show. And the first thing that came to my mind before I have you comment on this is Justice Roberts. I don't agree with a lot of his positions. I do think I'm glad that he's the Chief Justice right now, because he looks at the Supreme Court with a big, long overview and tries to protect its reputation. He made a comment after the Roe versus Wade. He made a comment and a separate opinion, which no other justice signed on to. But it's not that bad of an opinion, and it doesn't only apply to Roe versus Wade; it applies to a lot of things, and I think it applies to your show last week. Quote: "Both the court's opinion and the dissent display," and I'm quoting here now, "a relentless freedom from doubt on legal issues that I cannot share. broken down, what that means is every side, whether it's one side or the other, they have no doubt that they're right and they're not willing to budge. And I think that also applies to your commentary last week on President Biden, because I'm a Biden supporter. He wasn't my first choice, but I thought your report last week on Biden was spot on. But once again, in today's politically charged comments and atmosphere, things can just get out of whack.
Yeah, the Chief Justice's remarks about the extremity of intolerance on all sides of arguments these days is very timely, I think. And you know, amongst all the sound and fury, justifiable fury in many ways, about the Roe v. Wade being overturned, it went by fairly unnoticed. I'm glad you picked up on it. In my case, with the Biden question I was addressing last week, that while there are many things about the administration and the policies of Joe Biden to applaud, you can be a supporter of Biden and yet, like me, I suggest, and I know because of public reaction to my writings and my broadcasting, you can take a very strong position against him also. The two are not, on a particular piece of policy, and as you recall, and viewers may not, but listeners rather may not, I was finding fault with amongst this generally, I believe, this is a personal view only, the broad span of Biden administration policies are largely commendable. They're trying hard against great odds, of course. But the thing that stuck in my craw, and I could not accept, was the change in policy towards Saudi Arabia, and indeed a certain pusillanimousness about Israel, and in both those cases, it focused on the issue of journalists being killed. But nonetheless, we, as a nation now, because of this shift in policy, are dealing with governments that countenance the killing of journalists. The most extreme case being, of course, Saudi Arabia. And its crown prince, in particular, its crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, being responsible for the killing and dismemberment with a body saw. I can't gloss over that particular detail. The Washington Post columnist, Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi citizen, abducted and murdered inside Saudi Arabian diplomatic premises, but because of a policy shift and a concern over the availability of oil, the oil supply globally, in which Saudi Arabia, of course, plays such a part, we have to, says the argument of the Biden administration, shift our position and no longer do what Biden was promising to do, which is to treat Saudi Arabia as a pariah because of this disgusting murder. Instead, get their cooperation in order to fight combat high prices for oil, especially, of course, for American car drivers and the trucking industry and all those others. Just about everybody, in fact, affected by high fuel prices. It's a position which is a sustainable position. I would say that you can applaud a government and yet still find fault with some particular parts of its policies. Indeed, if it wasn't for that principle being a good one, we wouldn't have the or have had the lively press and its important role in democracy over the last couple of centuries. But you're right to point to the danger of it, of that no longer necessarily always being the case, that there is an intemperance now that's grown up in the political field and in other fields too, social policy and matters that that once upon a time were not a matter of factionalism and partisanship have become polarized to the point where you're talking about not just an opponent, an opponent in argument, but some kind of enemy, and that's a terrible reflection on a divided partisan society. It means that we have no prospect, or very little prospect, and the proof is in the pudding. Look at the logjam in Congress. There is no prospect of sensible agreement around policies anymore, and all we have is might is right, and the numbers are all, even when it's only a majority of one, and that's not a good recipe for a healthy body politic.
No, and what's so weird about this is it's a phenomenon that is worldwide, and not only in this country, and it doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, an independent, a liberal, a progressive, a conservative. It doesn't matter. The absolute ability for people to just draw the line and that is it, is contrary to everything our Constitution and our country was founded on. I mean, our Congress and our Senate, one of the great things about it, in my opinion, the fact that you could have compromise where parties would put things before and people would settle for a compromise. That is almost completely out the window now, and not only party to party, but individual parties as well. And people like you, that just give an overview of their thoughts and their opinions, and all of a sudden there's very little tolerance for that. There's no give or take.
Sure. And yet, look around and you'll see the signs may be very small in their occurrence, and you may need a microscope to see them. But there are instances where it shows that the old principles are still maintained. I was just talking about how amongst these leaders who clung on desperately to power, Draghi was something of an exception in Italy. And he went through the democratic process fully. He submitted to a no-confidence vote. He went to the symbolic representation of power in Italy, the constitutional president, and said, look, I am being forced to resign because of this this no-confidence vote. I'm very willing to go. And the president said, well, look, can you try, to reason with your opponents, see if you can get an agreement. And, willingly and perhaps more in hope than realism, he went back and talked to his enemy. They were behaving like enemies, although they were supposed to be coalition partners. And sad thing is, of course, they said no, then they were going to fight it to the end. And he did have to leave, and now we have a general election coming up in Italy. And interestingly, that other example I was citing, Sri Lanka, although, it was a revolt of the people that sent the corrupt president packing off the island and to some refuge in Singapore, and he bounced around Asia for a little bit. But what was interesting, again, it's a small detail, but it's telling, I think, what the crowd were demanding throughout that was that the man resigned. And it was extraordinary to see. You know, you remember the pictures of the images of people dousing themselves in the showers and the pool of the presidential residence and lying on the presidential bed, all in pretty good mood, actually. I mean, a real contrast with the storming of the U.S. Capitol, I have to say. But clearly, a demonstration of really quite serious people power, sending a president overseas. But they were insistent upon the constitutional detail. They wanted to see a piece of paper, or in fact an electronic email, that said, I resign. And that was quite a contentious issue for several days. And they wanted the proper form to be observed. And I think reforms of democracy are important. You know, they kind of underline that desire that you were so clearly and eloquently voicing, Marshall, that the finding of consensus and compromise is an essential part of democracy, and the forms are very important for its maintenance.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's, and this has not been something that's kind of, this has creeped up on us basically since the election of George Bush, Gore Bush. It's crept up on us at an increasing speed. But before we go, I have to bring this up one more time because we won't be talking about it much ever. I did get a chuckle yesterday in one news, and it comes from none other than Boris Johnson. I'm sorry. Yes, but his hasta la vista, baby line, by signing off, to me, just, you know what? I needed a good laugh for the day, and I got it there. I know it's not something to laugh about, but Boris Johnson, it was Boris Johnson to the end.
Oh, sure. And it's not quite the end yet. You remember that... you know, he'll still be there in order to, well, some say, in order to enjoy the perks of the prime ministerial country residence of Chequers as the venue for a celebration of his wedding. So he won't go yet. It'll be September before we have a new prime minister. But yes, Boris is always Boris. And of course, in that capacity for not taking himself so seriously, although deep down I think he's a deeply proud individual, he's cultivated this manner of a kind of affability and jokesterism, including about himself, that was essential to his rise. He was. Almost a clown figure, and Britain was in the mood for a clown figure, it seems. And I think the downside of that is that Britain had, after the you know, some grim period, was almost grateful to get a jokester in charge, something of a clown. And that was part of his personality that appealed to lots of people, and you know, in a way, it still does appeal. We can still laugh at the guy coming out with a good line, even in extremists, and that, of course, is a virtue that. You know, it's always been admired in Britain. Parliamentary question time is an instance of parliamentary wit being sharpened to the point where zingers are very much in vogue. It's a vogue which has lasted for just about ever. As long as we've had Parliament, we've had parliamentary wit. And his own popular slangy way of adapting that for public performance in general is one of Boris's distinguishing features. Not that distinguished, but you know, I think we can be grateful for it and look on it a little bit fondly. Even while, you know, in the spirit of being balanced, I think we can say that he was not exactly one of Britain's greatest leaders.
No, but, you know, years from now, they'll still be talking about him because of Brexit.
Oh, sure. An accomplishment. An accomplishment which may have long-term effects of a very negative nature. And they're already becoming apparent. We can deal with this in another week, and I'm sure we will.
Well, it's always interesting, David, to take a look around at what's going on, and maybe next week we'll sit down and we'll take a look and recap what has come out of the January 6th hearings and see what might happen in the future.
Absolutely. Ready for anything.
All right. Well, enjoy the great state of Maine.
I intend to.
Okay.
Talk to you next week.
Take care. David Tarachuk with The Media Beat. You can find David on the web at his website, themediabeat.us, and, of course, at our website at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on The Media Beat with David Tarachuk.